Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Dreyfus, an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iran, the war on terrorism, and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, Tom Paine, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He is the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Dreyfus.
Thanks. Always great to be here.
And the talks between the G5 plus one in Moscow with Iran appear to have been, shall we say, less than fruitful. It seems that the Iranian delegation took up much of Monday with a list of grievances going back many decades against the West, and they've sort of agreed to have lower-level talks, you know, without admitting that this round of talks have been a complete failure, which they appear to have been. It seems to me that this may indicate this deep well of bitterness that exists between Iran and the United States. Would that explain why the Iranians used up so much of the time, instead of negotiating, listing their grievances?
Well, you know, both sides have a long list of grievances, and I don't think that means, however, that the current round of talks was a complete failure. I think it's very important that over the last 3 months, there's now been a series of three world meetings between big powers and Iran, and that the talks are going to continue going forward. It's not something that anyone should think could be resolved quickly. And I'm really, in fact, encouraged by the fact that the administration in the United States is still talking, as well as the fact that the Iranians are still talking, because I think they know deep underneath what the shape of an agreement might look like. But getting from here to there is going to require concessions on both sides, not just on one side. And I'm not sure that either the United States or Iran want to make those concessions before the election. Both countries have elections in November for president of the United States and in June for president of Iran. So my guess is that the talks will probably continue through next summer until they get serious. And that's all to the good, because among other things, as long as the talks are going on, we're not going to hear very loud war cries from anybody, because they know that they can't really attack Iran as long as the negotiations underway.
Well, but every time I speak to Iranians, whether they are on the left or members of the communist Tudeh party that was essentially eradicated by the Islamists, or the Islamists, those sympathetic to the Islamic Republic of Iran's government, invariably Mossadegh is brought up and the coup against him and how the West has imposed the Shah on them and all that bitterness. And then on the American side, of course, the fact that the hostages were taken in the U.S. embassy, and that ever since then there's been this endless litany of the great Satan, etc., and death to America, death to America. I don't think it plays very well with the average American. How much is that a problem here? You don't see these atmospherics of being really an important ingredient here?
I think they're important in that they've created animosity over many decades. But I don't think that's what the negotiations are about. I mean, we negotiated agreements with the USSR on arms limitation, with all kinds of political and other grievances going back many years. And so I just think we don't expect these talks to lead to an American-Iran alliance or some sort of happy reconciliation. They're simply about an agreement to solve one particular problem. It's not going to solve the issue of Iran's relationship with Iraq or the Arabs. It's not going to solve Iran's relationship to Hamas and Hezbollah. It's not going to solve the responsibility of the United States for overthrowing Mossadegh, which, after all, was more than 60 years ago. And it's, I mean, these things just are too difficult to put into one negotiation. So I don't see why an agreement can't be reached, but the political obstacle is that if Obama were to get up tomorrow and say, yes, Iran has the right to enrich uranium, he would be attacked by the Republicans and it would become a political issue in the election. There's no solution without him saying that. That's part of the deal that has to be reached. By the same token, if the Iranians were to say, we're going to open up our country to complete intrusive inspections by the IAEA and other agencies, and we agree to limit our enrichment of uranium to 3 to 5% for fuel only, then that's going to open up a whole political crisis inside Iran among people, especially their hawks, who think that any kind of agreement that limits Iran's freedoms is the work of the devil. So these things are difficult to solve. I think they can be solved. But the practical political obstacles between now and next summer are enormous.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Dreyfuss, an investigative journalist who's written extensively on Iran, the war on terrorism, and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, Tom Paine, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. Now, Robert, the lead Iranian negotiator, Saeed Jalili, he reiterated Iran's basic position that the enrichment of uranium is non-negotiable. You're suggesting that if the President Obama agreed with that, Mitt Romney would be all over him in a second, which he already is at any rate, suggesting that Obama gives too much away. And that's probably why Obama can't apologize to the Pakistanis to open up the supplies into Afghanistan. But nevertheless, there was a sort of very self-righteous tone in what Jalili was saying. There is no reason or excuse to have doubt regarding the peaceful aims of Iran's nuclear program. Now, they keep saying that, but the obvious fact is that nobody in the West, and particularly in the United States, believes that, right? The bottom line here seems to be that the assumption on the part of the Americans, and even more so on the part of the Israelis, is that Iran simply cannot have a nuclear weapon.
Well, I think there are two different issues here that are entangled. One is the right to enrich uranium domestically for civilian purposes. The other is the right to enrich uranium to bomb grade, which is highly enriched uranium, and then give Iran the potential to turn that uranium into a nuclear weapon. Now, it should be said that Iran is a long way from being able to manufacture atomic weapons. They just don't have the material. We aren't even sure that they have the technology. They don't have the missiles to deliver one. This is a very difficult process and could take them years to master. So it isn't like this is an urgent threat that needs to be dealt with immediately. So that's the first point to make. Second is that I'm as skeptical as the next person about why Iran is developing this fuel cycle and enriching uranium. Maybe, in fact, they do want to manufacture a bomb further down the road. Maybe they just want to get close to that ability, the so-called turn of the screw close, where they can then become a nuclear power quickly, but not quite cross the threshold. Maybe they are sincere, although I find it hard to believe that they intend only to enrich uranium for fuel. But whatever the truth of it is, this is a struggle for power in which Iran is going to have to make concessions if it wants to end the economic sanctions and the political isolation that it's facing. And the United States is going to have to make concessions if it wants to get something serious from Iran. So when Jalili, as you say, notes that Iran is not going to give up its right to enrich uranium, I think that that is the bottom line for the Iranians. And the United States has edged toward accepting that over the past 2 years. And there have been many people engaged in back-channel talks with Iran who've explored that notion as well and come away convinced that there's a deal to be made there. Senator John Kerry said that a couple of years ago, that Iran does in fact have the right to enrich uranium. And the Obama administration is getting close to saying that, but that's their trump card. They can't play it without some reciprocal concession from Iran, and that's the difficulty in this negotiation. So the Iranians say, we want sanctions to be lifted before we do anything else. Under the current circumstances, that's a non-starter. So maybe there's some plan where sanctions could be gradually eased in exchange for step-by-step compliance by Iran. But all this, you know, this is difficult stuff for diplomats. They need to work out all kinds of intricate agreements while realizing that the other side could walk away at any moment. That's why I think it's going to take a while, and we should just all take a deep breath and let the negotiations proceed and realize that the people who are calling for bombing Iran are extremists. It's not a necessary step because Iran isn't that close to having a bomb, and it wouldn't be, as so many people have said, wouldn't be effective anyway. So,
but when you say, Robert, Robert Dreyfus, that it's that this we have to allow this laborious and painstaking diplomatic process to proceed. On the other hand, it's pretty simple, isn't it? If you say Kerry has indicated, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, that Iran has the right to enrich. Of course, Iran has the right to enrich, and everybody has said that, but within internationally recognized safeguards. And a lot of the suspicion is that these underground facilities have been discovered not by IAEA inspectors, but by intelligence agencies, and that there's been a history of secrecy here. So it's really a very simple thing. If the Iranians really want to give up, want to enrich uranium, and they are able to do it under internationally agreed safeguards. So that's where the rub is, and they're somehow, for some reason or other, prepared to pay an enormous price on their economy and on their people in order to have this right to enrich.
That's true, but the United Nations Security Council resolutions that have passed over the past 5 years call on Iran to suspend all enrichment. So the official position of the P5 plus one is not that Iran has the right to enrich uranium. Their official position is that Iran has to suspend enrichment and open itself to inspectors to make sure that everything is on the up and up. And in exchange for that, they have not pledged to lift sanctions besides. So the Iranians are faced with a unilateral demand from the West that they suspend their enrichment, that they open up for inspections with no guarantees that they get any relief from economic sanctions.
Robert, that's not the West. It's the P5 plus one, which are the five permanent members of the Security Council, Russia, China, United States, Britain, France, plus Germany. I mean,
that's what I said. These are United Nations Security Council resolutions.
Right, so that's not the West.
But we know who's driving this. It isn't
right, but the fact that the Russians and the Chinese, who are very sympathetic to Iran, have joined in it, surely that says something, doesn't it?
Well, it says that partly they're trying to, you know, keep the peace between the West and Iran, and they're also, you know, not in favor of Iran developing a nuclear weapon. But they've opposed any draconian sanctions against Iran. So most of the economic sanctions that have been imposed on Iran are unilateral or multilateral ones outside of the UN resolutions. In other words, they're by the United States, they're by Western Europe. And those are the things which are hurting Iran now, not the economic sanctions that come out of the UN resolutions. But in the meantime, the UN resolutions, which Russia and China support, do say that Iran has to suspend its nuclear program. And in order to back down from that, that's an important step. That's a big deal. It's not just as easy as you say to say, oh, well, Iran has the right to enrich uranium, because that's their trump card. That's what they have to play in order to get real concessions from Iran. And so far, the Iranians aren't willing to make the first move, and neither is the P5 plus one. So, you know, are they saying this to each other behind the scenes? We don't know, because nobody, you know, is on the inside of these meetings. The Iranians' last meeting was in Moscow, and they had frank talks just one-on-one between the Russian delegation and the Iranian one. And as you know, Obama just met President Putin this week, and I'm sure is working very closely with Russia, trying to get Russia to, you know, put pressure on Iran. But Russia has its own real interests at stake, and so does Iran, and so does China, and not everybody wants to do America's bidding, so this is very complex. And that's why I'm saying 3 years ago, everyone was talking about, is Israel going to bomb Iran? Now, thanks to this diplomacy, the Obama administration has changed the topic, and we've stopped talking about an imminent military attack, and we're talking about talks, which is good. That's progress. And if it takes another 2 years to reach an agreement, I'm okay with that. There's no big hurry.
Well, as you know, Robert Dreyfus, Flint Leverett, who was formerly in charge of the Iran desk at the National Security Council under President George W. Bush, he's recently wrote an article suggesting that the Obama administration, of course, the assumption is that they want to negotiate till after the elections, and maybe they made a deal with Israel to give them a green light. But Flint Leverett says no. He's convinced that the Obama administration actually wants to go to war against Iran.
Yeah, well, I don't agree with that at all. I don't think that the Obama administration has the slightest intention of going to war with Iran. It is not comparable to George Bush and Iraq, because the Bush administration did want to go to a war with Iraq. It did fabricate reasons to do so, and then it went to war. I think the last thing that the Obama administration wants is war with Iran. In fact, they're much more concerned, as you know, about what they call the pivot to Asia, about issues relating to China, and about the global economic crisis, which would be dramatically worse if there was war with Iran, because that would completely destroy the oil market. It would send all kinds of countries beyond Greece and Spain into a downward spiral toward disaster. It would probably collapse the world's financial markets. So we're talking about, you know, a catastrophic event in terms of what it would mean to attack Iran. And I just don't see any, I mean, there's no evidence that Obama wants to go to war. Even Dennis Ross, who was one of the most hawkish members of the Obama administration until recently, who just left his post, has just come out saying that the United States ought to recognize Iran's right to enrich uranium. That's a big deal. People are moving in that direction. And, you know, I know Flint Leverett. I have a lot of respect for his work, but I just don't see any evidence. And by the way, not just me, but I think most experts would agree that there's no evidence that the Obama administration wants a war, quite the opposite.
Well, just in closing, Robert Dreyfus, Catherine Ashton, the European Union's foreign policy chief and the lead negotiator for the G5 plus one, she said that that there is a possibility that the six powers might be willing to relax one of the sanctions that's been threatening Iran, and that is a provision that bans insurers based in Europe from covering ships that carry Iranian oil anywhere in the world. That's obviously, the sanctions are beginning to bite. What do you make of that?
Well, that would be, I think, a constructive way of showing that there's some good faith maybe somewhere mixed up in all of this. Of course, part of the reason that they're talking about that is that there are a lot of people in the West, in London, where the world oil insurance market is based, among world oil companies, among the Japanese and Koreans and Indians and Chinese who get oil from Iran, all of whom would be very upset if some measure like the one you just described were implemented that shuts down Iran's oil exports to those countries in Asia. So, there's a lot of people, I think, around the world who would like to see that sanction avoided. Whether it happens or not, I don't know. But I think that's, if it does happen, I think that would be the start of perhaps, the beginning of a step-by-step process that would move things forward in the talks.
So at this point, the sanctions are beginning to bite, and you think that there's a possibility of a give and take on both sides?
Yeah, well, it's more than beginning to bite. I mean, I think that the economic sanctions of the past 12 months or so have been quite severe in terms of affecting Iran's economy. The fact is, however, that as true as that is, until we see signs of mass labor strikes or unrest or other political problems, that has no relationship to the decision-making process in Iran, because its leaders aren't affected. And so even if the economy is in bad shape, the only way that could affect their decision-making about the nuclear program is if they felt that their political regime was threatened. And just so far, there's no evidence of that. So I don't think the sanctions are productive politically. In fact, they may be counterproductive, because they're getting a lot of Iranians mad at the United States and the West, and not mad at their leadership. It was only 3 years ago that Iranians were gathering in the streets in millions to protest what they felt was a rigged election. And now a lot of those people who were probably out in the streets may be rallying to the government's side because they feel like Iran is under attack.
Well, Robert Drivers, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yes, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Drivers, an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iran, the war on terrorism, and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, Tom Paine, and other, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. We're going to take a brief station break and be back in a moment talking about the sacking of Pakistan's prime minister.
I'm sorry, so sorry, that I was such a fool. I didn't know love could be so cruel.